Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in East Asian Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ed Pulford, one of the hosts of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Andre Abrahamian, who's Correct Fellow at the Asia-Pacific Research Center at Stanford University, about his new book, North Korea and Myanmar, Divergent Paths, which was published last year, 2018, by Macfarlane. At what often seems like a period of unprecedented stress in global relations, whether between China and the US, Russia and the West at large, or among many other parties, disputes and conflicts can tell us a lot about how the international community or international order is supposed to function in theory. Andre Abrahamian's Divergent Paths, which counterposes and explains North Korea's and Myanmar's long careers as pariah states within this order, is thus a timely account of two comparable yet quite different Asian countries which have arguably shed the starkest light on the global order's disorderly fringes. Years of experience travelling to and living in both places gives Abrahamian a unique perspective on this pair of outposts of tyranny, as former US Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice dubbed them in 2005. This first-hand knowledge is mobilized to great effect in what is a lively account of why one country, Myanmar, has to some extent managed to emerge from its pariah position in recent years, whilst the other, North Korea, remains largely excluded, whatever hopes we might have amidst recent signs of greater contacts across the 38th parallel. Indeed, this book helps us to appreciate this latest warming of inter-Korean relations in its deeper context. For understanding the DPRK's uniquely resilient socio-political system and its interaction with the world around it is likely to be invaluable in parsing what may lie ahead for East Asia's most intractable geopolitical problem. On Myanmar too, the book offers fresh and valuable perspective. For as Abrahamian shows, the country's recent partial resumption of international outcast status amidst the horrifying Rohingya crisis emerges from a long history of religious and ethnic fragmentation in the country and official mismanagement of this. In any case, though, to discuss the book and some of its wider ramifications, I'd like to say, Andre Abrahamian, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, thanks very much for agreeing to appear. It's a great book and tells us a lot about two countries that I think it's pretty important to understand, as I mentioned. But before we jump in, perhaps I could ask you to start us off by saying something about yourself and how you became interested in these two places and came to sort of focus on them academically.
Yeah, I was doing a PhD focused on North Korea, and at the nadir of that experience in 2010, I decided that I should at least go and try to see the place if I was going to dedicate my life to banging out my precious ideas about it. From a distance, I thought I should at least take a look at it up close. So I booked a tour, and I went, as most citizens of the world can do, visited North Korea for 5 days, and I thought, okay, this is interesting enough to continue with this life choice. And then I also started trying to think of ways that I could actually work with North Koreans and engage them personally rather than just think about them from a distance. By chance, I was introduced to a young Singaporean fellow, Jeffrey C. And at the time, he was just getting a project rolling, which would become Joseon Exchange. Joseon Exchange, a nonprofit that trains North Koreans in economic policy and entrepreneurship. So I jumped at the chance to get involved with that. And eventually we won enough support that I was able to move to Beijing and run programs in North Korea and also bring North Koreans abroad for training as well, mostly in Singapore. Mm-hmm. Working in North Korea is in many ways very stressful, and living in Beijing is also in many ways very stressful. And when my wife was offered a job in Yangon, she came to me and was like, should we do this? Would be crazy, right? We shouldn't. This is a madness. And I was like, no, let's do it. Because this was 2014, moving into 2015. Myanmar really was emerging from its isolation. And I thought I would be able to potentially learn something about what happens when a pariah state comes in from the cold, so to speak. And so ended up living there for a couple of years. And within a couple of months, I started thinking that this could turn into a book project, by which I compared and contrasted the two countries, because there was really nothing out there that attempted to do that. There's been no books, plenty of papers and journal articles thinking about the relationship between the two countries as they cooperated during their pariah days. But very little that sought to compare the systems that made them pariahs and made them so resilient to the pressure that they were facing from the outside world.
Mm-hmm. And was your earlier doctoral work relating to North Korea also on this sort of subject, the kind of idea of pariah nationhood or this kind of thing? Or what kind of focus did you have at that stage?
I was looking at the way media and nonfiction media treats North Korea, the way that ideas about the place are formed and how that impacts how we think about the country and the policy outcomes that may or may not lead us to as well.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So I guess the kind of understanding the place in context and its relationship to a wider external world was already there in your mind. That's fascinating. And in terms of writing the book, at what point did you sort of sit down and sort of decide to really do that? And how did the actual process of writing it kind of emerge in terms of jumping between two different locations, the structure? How did you sort of conceive of the book as a whole like that?
I guess fairly early, you know, it was clear that the North Koreans had built a system that was far more controlled than the North Koreans, and far more resilient in its closed form than anything the Burmese ever came up with. So I don't think I wrote the book in the order that it appears. I began by comparing and contrasting the ideologies on which both states rest and the systems of control or consent building that exist in them as well. And then because this was a period in which Myanmar was emerging from isolation, I started trying to think through other reasons beyond sort of resilience that country was able to make that change.
Given that that's the sort of the background to the project as a whole, I think we should kind of get into the contents here, and it should segue pretty smoothly into the introduction, in which you ask or pose the question, why these countries? Why is it that these two in particular make a good comparison? So could you say a little bit more in answer to that question?
Yeah, and you know, there are a couple of questions I get quite frequently about it, criticisms that are fully valid. One of them is, you know, what's the value in comparing these two quite different countries? You know, how can you compare countries that are so vastly different, you know, Burma is a multi-ethnic, tropical country that lies at the where ASEAN meets India, meets Southwest China. And North Korea, on the other hand, is a often frozen Northeast Asian state that has created a real garrison through which, at times, very little flows, both in terms of trade and information. And I think you could argue also cultural inputs as well. I think for me, I immediately saw enough there to warrant a comparison. These were both the only post-war pariah states in Asia, in the East Asia region. They're both incredibly militarized states, relying on the military as both the only really functioning institution for a period of time in both cases, and indeed the driving cultural as well as organizational force in both countries. Mm-hmm. And really they're the two countries that just sat with folded arms as this incredible belt of prosperity was created, starting in Singapore and stretching all the way up through China and Japan. No other country really failed to participate quite as much as these two, although clearly Laos and Cambodia are laggards as well. It was, for me, I think, clearly connected to the fact that both of these countries are awkward agglomerations of people, or they don't fit an elegant set of boundaries for a nation state. Mm-hmm. I understand that that's certainly not a unique experience for post-colonial state formation. Mm-hmm. But I think it's particularly acute in these two countries. Burma cobbled together in a way that is extremely awkward by the British, and then Korea divided at the end of the Second World War. By all accounts, if there is going to be a natural, I'm making air quotes, I know you can't see it, but a natural nation state, the Korean Peninsula is one of the better candidates, ethnically homogenous, et cetera, et cetera. What we've had since 1945 is two competing states. And so in both cases, extremely difficult to sort of consolidate the independence that came after the collapse of the Japanese empire.
Sure. And we'll probably come on a bit more to the sort of history of the formation of both places in a second. But I just thought I'd jump back for a moment to your personal experiences there. I mean, in terms of commonalities or differences and this justification, as you mentioned, for comparing the two, having spent long periods of time, or in the case of North Korea, certainly many, many repeat visits in the countries themselves, was your sense of there being a similar atmosphere for you as a person, as an outsider coming into those societies? Was there some commonality of experience that you felt on a kind of ground level amongst ordinary people that merited the comparison?
Well, unfortunately for me, but very fortunately, I would say, for the people of Myanmar, by the time I first visited that country in 2014, the atmosphere was basically very open and friendly. So the stories that I heard from locals and indeed long-term expats, people who'd been there in the early and mid-2000s, even the 1990s, their descriptions of it sounded really quite similar to the experience of living in Pyongyang. Extremely difficult to have conversations with locals, for example, as a visitor. People would not speak openly. People would be certainly wary of any interaction that would draw the attention of secret police, who were everywhere in Burma, although perhaps not as everywhere as they wanted you to think. that they certainly managed to create an atmosphere where people were worried about interacting with foreigners, where it was a risk. But still much looser than in North Korea. So for example, you could even as a journalist or a researcher sneak into Burma on a tourist visa, travel on your own. You know, you would be followed, but you could often lose your tail, so to speak, and be picked up again later down the road or in the neighboring town and, you know, be asked to leave or told to leave. Mm-hmm. That sort of ability to roam or visit people's homes even is just not allowed in Pyongyang. So even though they did create a very restrictive and repressive atmosphere for foreigners in Yangon, it didn't approach what the North Koreans have created. By 2014, everything was pretty normal. Indeed, every taxi driver and anyone else you interacted was happy to complain about the government.
Mm. And yet that wasn't your, I mean, perhaps it goes without saying, but since you're someone with such a unique experience of time in North Korea and contact with many North Korean citizens or from groups who certainly tourists of the country don't really get the chance to talk to, that wasn't your experience of the North Koreans you'd spent time with.
Yes. Definitely not. Certainly not somebody you were interacting with, you know, for the first or even second or third times in North Korea. Maybe once you develop a relationship with someone, some cautiously expressed dissatisfactions will emerge, or, you know, underlying cynicisms will bubble up. But if you meet someone for the first time, almost certainly you will hear nothing that contradicts the official party line.
Well, that's interesting in terms of in terms of the atmosphere. But as you mentioned, the kind of historical depth that this book goes into, I think, accounts for why the comparison makes sense in light of the fact that Burma, Myanmar was perhaps a bit more like that in past times. So we'll go back to those past times as we move into chapter one, and you've already alluded to the slightly awkward or very awkward formation of each state and how each one was either respectively cobbled together or cut apart as you conceive of it in the chapter heading. Could you just provide a bit more background to listeners on the sort of on the history, on the sort of post-colonial and post-imperial history of the formation of each place?
So in Myanmar, which was a British colony called Burma, gradually taken over the course of the 19th century in three different wars with multi-decade interregna in between. The British were chased out by the Japanese during World War II and then came back and kicked the Japanese out. Littered the country with weapons. Guns were extremely easy to get a hold of. Everybody had one. And such was the fervor for independence that the British couldn't remain. You know, there were hopes of creating sort of a trusteeship, a transition period of stewardship before independence. Indeed, that was something that the Americans and the Soviets wanted for Korea as well, but in neither case would the citizenry tolerate such a thing. So you have essentially two parts of Burma, Lower and Upper Burma, an incredibly diverse range of ethnic groups. Officially, the state there recognizes 8 main ethnic groups with 135 subgroups. Anthropologists that I've spoken to roundly call that a bunch of nonsense. And indeed, you can't avoid coming across anthropologists in Yangon. It's Myanmar, I think, is interesting to your type of person, Ed. But the roots of that categorization go back to the colonial period. Europeans, as they want to do, show up somewhere and begin reifying people, putting them in categories. And so what was once a much more fluid and in a way ambiguous set of overlapping identities became reified, that contributed to the conflict that emerged very quickly after independence. Basically, the father of modern Burma was Aung San. He's a general and Aung San Suu Kyi's father. He had a great deal of personal and political capital and respect from a wide swath of Burmese society, including ethnic minority groups. Unfortunately, he was assassinated in 1947, and then there was really no person or coalition that were able to hold things together. So within a couple of years of his death, there were all sorts of insurgencies breaking out. Many were driven by ethnicity. So the Karen, a large minority that make up, I think, still, I would say, 8% of the contemporary population, mm-hmm. they were an open rebellion and controlled a big chunk of the middle of the country. The communists, who were originally part of a ruling coalition, they left actually in two sort of batches, two factions, and went underground and began waging a guerrilla war. And then dozens of other armies followed suit. Mm. I quote Mary Callahan in the book, a scholar at the University of Washington, who points out that it wasn't clear that the Tatmadaw, the official army of the state, was anything other than one of many small armies duking it out for a little piece of this country. Mm. Conflict began almost immediately after independence and really remained a threat to the state, I argue in the book, until the 1990s. Yeah, in Korea, on the other hand, the Soviets and the Americans end up, at the end of World War II, occupying a half of the country each and setting about building rival states. The leadership on both sides of that divide really want to unify the peninsula on their terms. Kim Il-sung decides he's going to go for it first and initiates a war in June of 1950. And that is essentially fought to a standstill once the Americans cobble together a coalition of UN forces and fight their way back up the peninsula. Mm. But they end up, after a 3-year incredibly gruesome war, at the line where they began almost. So 3 years of fighting to get basically nowhere. The two states still exist and go about trying to rebuild and compete with each other. From North Korea's perspective, you know, their rightful territory, the Korean Peninsula, is only not under their control because a hostile superpower, an imperialist power, as they would put it, has occupied half of it, almost interrupted since 1945, thus thwarting the completion of the Korean Revolution. And creating the need, as they would see it, for nuclear weapons and all the other things they've gotten up to over the years.
Mm. Well, we'll perhaps move on to that now, because having got a sense of the as you said at the start there, somewhat unnatural or awkward, if there is indeed, as you also mentioned, a natural way of making a nation state. Yes, in any case, there's, I think, little doubt that both of these places are constructed in a way that makes them not quite fit the boundaries that are either around or indeed within them. We move on then to things like nuclear weapons, but perhaps via smaller scale weapons first. You focus on chapter two on the militarization of both societies and how that was prioritized over the economy. Could you say something about how that unfolded and kind of what it was about the circumstances in which each state emerged that led to this militarization, and what the similarities and differences between the process in each place were?
Yeah, it really took place around the same time in both countries, which was in the early to mid 60s. So in Myanmar, they had a parliament, a civilian government that was deadlocked and seemed to be unable to deal with the country's problems. The military were invited in 1958 to initiate a constitutional coup. I'm making air quotes again. Nonetheless, that's what they did. They gave up power a couple of years later, returned it to the civilians, having stabilized the economy. The civilians immediately began faffing around again, and the military return with another coup in 1962, this time without any pretensions of giving power back. They set about creating a socialist state, and so nationalize property and create essentially an environment in which the military is leading this road to socialism, and it becomes really the primary, in some ways only functioning institution in the country. Moreover, there are still various insurgencies raging around the country, and in the mid-1960s, the Tatmadaw, as the Burmese military was and still is called, came up with a counterinsurgency strategy, which they implemented in 1968. They call it Pya Le Pya, or the Four Cuts, which essentially is a way of denying resources, cutting resources off from insurgents. So really, both in terms of economic and social organization, the military came to the front in the 60s. And then in terms of a solution to this core security threat of insurgency, again, it was going to be a military solution rather than a political one. In North Korea, they'd had a couple of successful multi-year plans after the Korean War to rebuild. They had a three-year plan and then a five-year plan, which took them to 1961. And then they initiated a seven-year plan, which was supposed to help develop light industry and consumer goods. But instead, resources came to be poured into the military to the extent that, according to some estimates, and there's a lot of guesswork here, military spending shot up from 2 or 3% of GDP to possibly as high as 30. And that was for a few different reasons. I think ultimately Kim Il-sung hadn't given up on unifying the peninsula by force and or inspiring a revolution in the south. And the international conditions were also such that he had lost faith in the USSR, and a number of things with China also made him feel like he was very much on his own, and that a garrison state was necessary in order to survive against this hostile superpower that wasn't going anywhere.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's...
Yeah, sure. Sure. And you mentioned then that, or at least you sort of move on in the next chapter to how it was that these circumstances led to pariahdom, if you will, becoming pariah states. Was it an outside reaction to this militarization and the sort of hampering, therefore, of economic development that brought these saw these two countries both become pariahs, or what was it that sort of set that dynamic in motion, and how was it related to the militarization side?
Yeah, I think you referenced it in your introduction, which is that this militarization took place during the Cold War, and during that bipolar conflict. As a smaller state, you could find a home in one camp or another, almost regardless of how you were running your country or how you were treating your people. So, you know, if you were a socialist state, you could find backing from the USSR and or China. And, you know, if you were anti-communist, didn't matter what you did, really, the Americans would find a way to support you.
Mm.
And so... you know, really, during the Cold War, South Africa was sort of this weird outlier, but almost every other serial human rights abuser, autocratic or totalitarian state was able to exist without facing the sorts of pressures that we've seen come to bear post-Cold War. I would argue that neither became a pariah until the Cold War had ended. Although, you know, that might be a bit too elegant. I think the end of the Cold War also inspired decisions in both capitals that very directly led to their pariah status.
Hmm. So is, in that sense, I mean, would you go as far as to say that the idea of a pariah is something of a post-Cold War artifact? I mean, is this was this just not something that that existed before the Cold War ended?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. That's something that we as scholars and authors we need to occasionally be able to have the confidence to say I'm not sure. But when you think back to the Cold War period, really, other than South Africa, it's hard to think of a universally or near universally condemned society the way North Korea and Myanmar, Burma have been.
And then at the end of the Cold War itself, sort of domestically in both countries, of course not unrelated to what was going on internationally, but there seem to have been some key events at the end of the 80s and into the 90s, particularly the North Korean famine, and then protests in 1988 in Myanmar. Could you say something about how that sort of signaled a new kind of post-Cold War era in both places?
Yeah, well, from the North Korean perspective, you know, they see their allies basically vanish within a couple of years. It's the 1980s. Became the 1990s, and you know their remaining friends, China being the most significant. China was not the state that it is now. It's not the great power that it is today. So they in Pyongyang must have felt very much alone, and were still not brave enough, I would say, given the ongoing competition with South Korea, which by now is, of course, a very successful economic power, not brave enough to make the changes, take on the reforms that would have been necessary to create economic development and really political integration with the rest of the world. Instead, they went the other way. They remained closed economically. With the famine and industrial collapse being a direct result of their isolation. And then they chose to double down on the nuclear program, which had begun in the 1980s. Really, they'd been interested in having nuclear weapons forever. But they really started making moves towards developing it in the 1990s. On the Burma-Myanmar side of things, pretty amazingly, in 1998, the military declared an end to the socialist experiment, which had created incredible poverty. Burma was in many ways set up to be a very successful state. They had a huge agricultural base, pretty solid institutions in terms of a legal system and higher education, infrastructure, airports, rail, all pretty good in the mid-20th century. So the 26 years of socialism really just pissed that all away. And so by 1988, people were incredibly frustrated. In 1987, as you mentioned, they conducted a currency reform that eliminated what little wealth people had and created crazy inflation. And people began protesting. In response, the military said, okay, socialism is over. Aung San Suu Kyi comes into the scene at this point and forms a rival party. They're pretty ambivalent about her. They do put her under house arrest the next year in 1989. But the military also says, or the junta that they form in this sort of interregnum period also says, okay, we're going to have elections in May of 1990. And so they hold these elections, and guess what? their party just gets smashed to pieces. And it seems very much like they hadn't expected that, you know, and that can be a problem with dictatorships. The people at the very top can lose touch with what's going on in the countries that they rule. They seemed really, really surprised. And so they responded by extending Aung San Suu Kyi's detention and coming up with a variety of excuses for why power could not be transferred to her party, the National League for Democracy. And really, the fate of the democratization movement and Aung San Suu Kyi in particular is what drove sanctions and the pariah status that faced the Rangoon, now renamed Yangon, faced.
And so the end of the Cold War, as you say, marked the end of what was in Myanmar a socialist experiment, as you say. Well, I mean, 2 decades is quite a long experiment, I suppose. But I wonder, the next section that you have discusses ideologies and following that, how those ideologies and the sort of government ideas were enforced. But just as a sort of preface to that, could you say something a bit more about how socialism took root? Because obviously this is a point of commonality between the two states. I mean, where did leftist ideas come into Myanmar? I think, I mean, the North Korean case is perhaps a bit better known regarding Soviet influence and also, of course, the role of China. But in Myanmar, how did socialism sort of get into the picture there?
Yeah. This was the early 1960s. I think socialism and state ownership and a command economy had not yet been fully discredited as an efficient or productive way to organize society. And so, you know, I think these ideas were part of the milieu that developing recently independent states were facing. I guess it's somewhat ironic in that the military leader who took over in 1962, Ne Win, had been fighting actual communists since 1948. And yet, you know, then chose to steer his country dramatically towards a socialist path. At the end of the day, leaderships in both countries can be very inscrutable by design, and so it's difficult to know exactly why he decided to take that path.
Right, but the role of a state socialist model was something that both places shared, something which of course became problematized after the Cold War was over. So moving into this kind of post-1990s era in both places, how is it that each state respectively has ensured or sought to assert the control and the kind of dominance of the government over the population and the maintenance of the government in position? How successful has each place been, and what kind of valuable comparative dimensions are there to that?
Yeah, I think for me this is probably the most interesting part of the book, and probably its most useful contribution to understanding these two countries. In both cases, a state ideology was promulgated, and I think it's been a pretty humbling lesson for the West and diplomacy in general. The power of these ideologies is just much greater than I think most people assume. Certainly in the case of Myanmar, where I think we collectively kind of fooled ourselves into thinking that because much of the population supported Aung San Suu Kyi and were opposed to military rule, we thought that maybe they had also not accepted much of the ideology that the military had imposed on its people. And yet it seems very much that idea that there are 8 indigenous ethnicities and everyone else is to one degree or another an interloper, that really took hold and feeds directly into the Rakhine crisis, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya have been pushed onto the Bangladesh side of the border and live in absolute abject misery with no real solution in sight and no real sympathy in mainstream Myanmar society. The power of ideology in North Korea, I think, is again maybe slightly more evident, partly because they've exported it so aggressively since the mid 1960s. They tried to portray Kim Il Sung as a thought leader. His Juche ideology provides, they would argue, a framework for other small countries to follow in order to gain independence and autonomy. And then, as some more recent scholarship has pointed out, the North Koreans lean very heavily on ethno-nationalism to inspire people as well. And, you know, so much of North Korea can seem absurd on the face of it. The style of their propaganda, the edicts that come down from on high that people have to follow, I think to a lot of us just seem very antiquated and weird. And yet, I think one thing I observed from being there, and also my own personal family background, which is Armenian, is the idea that you are part of an ethnic family that is under siege from a hostile world is a really powerful one. Mm-hmm. And so as repressive as North Korea is and controlled as that society is, I do think they have a core set of ideas that can still motivate people and does have some resonance. Mm-hmm. And I think we've overlooked the power of ideology in both of these countries at the peril of successful diplomacy, for one, but also in failing to understand it, we haven't found means by which to improve the lot of either North Koreans or Myanmar citizens.
Mm-hmm. And well, yeah, I think as you mentioned, that is a really valuable contribution of the book, the description of the kind of content and the tenacity of these state ideologies. Of course, lots of ideas of ideology, lots of theories of ideology focus on the technologies too, and the way that these ideas are actually spread, and the way that their sort of dominance within society is ensured, whether that's social, political, or sort of even infrastructural technologies that are used to spread them. How has each country managed to inculcate these ideas, and what have actually been the concrete mechanisms in each place?
Yeah, what a fantastic question for providing a transition from chapter 4 to chapter 5, I must say.
I read the book, you know.
yes. No, you're good at your job. Chapter 5 is titled Propagation and Control, and as in so many other aspects of Burmese life, in comparison to North Korean life, the North Koreans just basically did it more comprehensively, more thoroughly. And part of that is because of the nature of North Korea. Once they sealed up the southern and northern borders, it essentially becomes a garrison or a fortress. Myanmar, much more porous, highlands, borders with multiple states, multiple ethnic minorities that have traditionally lived across what are now nation state boundaries and familiar with terrain going in and out. The Burmese also didn't control much of their territory for much of their history. And indeed, there's all these ethnic identities that create a very complicated mix of incentives and loyalties. And so into that, as you try to impose control over, radio and television and stamp out independent publishing or certainly broadcasting, as you try to control foreign journalists and indeed indoctrinate your citizens through education and through mass mobilization organizations, it's just much more difficult for Rangoon to conduct such a project. In North Korea, again, probably, better known just how well, they've done that. So, control over TV and newspapers and radio is absolute. Control of people and their travel in and out of the country is also fairly absolute, although far less than it used to be. After the famine, some degree of that control has broken down because North Korea has become largely a market economy and people want access to outside information. And, now some 30,000 people have escaped across the border. Those numbers were in the hundreds before the famine. And indeed, the in terms of the personal experience of a foreigner visiting North Korea today, you still have to basically be accompanied by two North Koreans at all times who are responsible for your conduct. There's no other country that runs such a system, and those in the region that did, China and Vietnam, basically abandoned it within a few years of their opening and reform process, where they quickly realized that, if we really want investors and visitors and tourism, this is not going to work. The North Koreans have stuck to that. In Myanmar, they never had that system. So even though there were plenty of spies and informants keeping track of you as a visitor, you could still sneak around. I include an anecdote in the book of a journalist friend of mine who went down to cover typhoon in 2008 and was able essentially to disguise himself as a Burmese person and get down to the delta that had been devastated. Such a daring act would just simply be impossible in North Korea.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. Well, I guess some of these distinctions between the situation in the two places play out as the book kind of moves into its final couple of chapters, where we actually talk about the kind of more contemporary fate of each place within this kind of international system that we were talking about earlier. Firstly, you deal with how sanctions have been imposed on each place and how effective those have been. And you referenced earlier the sort of misunderstanding or the perhaps misapprehension of what domestic ideologies and the way that they're enforced. You met the way the West has misunderstood those dynamics. How have sanctions sort of taken effect on both places? Have they largely come as a result of misunderstanding the situation in each place? How has each country responded differently to the enforcement of sanctions, usually US-led ones?
Three gigantic questions.
Sure. Take your pick.
Well, let's say when I first went to Myanmar in 2014, I walked into a shop that absolutely reminded me of any number of shops in North Korea. There's a commonality in sanctioned societies, I think, in how retail is presented and organized. You know, just a very eclectic cobbling together of any sorts of consumer goods that you can get your hands on. So, you know, chocolates from Russia and teddy bears that are made in Yemen and off-brand sneakers and rice cookers from Korea and just all sorts of things in a row. Mm-hmm. I was struck by how similarly, you know, options for consumption were constrained in both countries. The key difference in these two states is that there was a real advocate for sanctions in Burma, Myanmar, and that was Aung San Suu Kyi. And her incredible popularity at home meant that even as people's lives were being manifestly damaged by sanctions, they still supported them because she supported them. And she rightly assessed that those sanctions were empowering her vis-a-vis the regime.
Mm.
So, the Americans essentially said, we'll talk to you about sanctions relief when you are talking to Aung San Suu Kyi and you are treating her better and you are respecting her rights as a politician who has already won an election once in 1990. In North Korea, there's just no such advocate, and it's impossible really to imagine there ever being one. Mm. So sanctions, I think, have always been, you know, it would be a challenge to envision them ever working in North Korea the way they did in Myanmar. In Myanmar, sanctions in both countries, the leaderships want to get out from under sanctions. Mm-hmm. Obviously, mm-hmm. it's in their personal interest. It's in the interests of the coalition of ruling people around them. But when that desire to get out from under sanctions is stacked against what they see as a core issue of security and stability, that core issue is going to win out every time.
Mm.
And that
really is what you sort of propose as one key distinction in the final chapter when you discuss why it is that Myanmar has indeed had a quite different trajectory over the last few years to North Korea's. The kind of relationship between domestic security and the survival of the regime and the state and then the question of international integration. Could you flesh that out a little more? What is it how is it that dynamic has influenced the fact that Myanmar has sort of emerged, as you said, from some sort of from a to an extent from its pariah, while North Korea hasn't?
Yeah, I mean, first through the 1990s and early 2000s, the Tatmadaw was able to either buy out or roll over and all the key insurgencies, really. So now there's still some fighting going on in the north of the country, but none of the rebel armies really pose a genuine threat to the state, and nor will they ever do so. So first they consolidated that, and then really in the 2000s began turning towards addressing the issue of democracy and the fate of Aung San Suu Kyi in order to get out under the sanctions. And it took a long time. They first publicly announced a plan in 2003, a roadmap to a disciplined, flourishing democracy, as they catchily titled it, and then debated what that would look like for several years, you know, essentially trying to figure out what is the minimum amount of democracy we can give in order to satisfy both domestic and international stakeholders. Mm-hmm. And eventually this led to elections in 2010 and then again in 2012 that were the ones in 2012, free and fair, although within a structure that really privileges the military still. Mm-hmm. Importantly, I think in terms of a lesson to be drawn from Myanmar, sanctions in general, we slap them on for a number of reasons, mostly because we don't know what else to do. You know, we want to punish or try and coerce a state into behaving differently, but we don't want the costs of an actual war, and we don't want to sit idle and do nothing. And so you end up with sanctions as sort of this middle ground that really more often than not fails to achieve its goals, mm-hmm. especially when the goals are very broad and wide, when it's, you know, like democratize or, you know, end oppression of a particular minority. We're seeing this right now in Zimbabwe, I think, although I'm certainly no expert on Zimbabwe. There are sanctions imposed on that country related to corruption, to suppression of democracy by Mugabe, and land confiscation issues with white farmers. Zimbabwe still has the two former problems, but did have, by all accounts, free and fair elections, having pushed Mugabe out last year. And yet there's no end in sanctions in sight, because we don't really come up with very good mechanisms for getting rid of them, especially when the goals are very broad. And so what we saw in Myanmar was sanctions help create real scarcity at a time when the country was trying to return to a market economy that should have helped create a lot more efficiencies and opportunities. Instead, that scarcity really helped contribute to a consolidation of power by a handful of business people who were very close to the regime, and made it very difficult for smaller players to be successful. Mm. I think the tragedy for me is, looking back, if we asked in 1990 if all these rounds of sanctions were going to just create an entrenched economic elite connected to the military, and asked ourselves, would we still apply these sanctions? I think the answer is probably yes, just because, you know, the need to do something. Ah, I've made air quotes again. Look at me.
but we can't look at you. That's the point.
Instead of doing nothing.
Yeah.
And now we're at a point where sanctions, I think, would be completely ineffective, because the issue we would be sanctioning the Burmese on, which is the ethnic cleansing or genocide of the Rohingya, basically is supported by the majority of people there, and indeed even the civilian government. So we would only be, I think, furthering the aims of the people who want to push the Rohingya out if we were to sanction. You know, we, the greater we, would be the external bad guy, and sanctions would be seen as wholly illegitimate imposed by people who don't understand the country and its situation.
Sure. Well, and I think those reflections on the effectiveness or otherwise of sanctions is a provocative subject as well to think about, given what's likely to be coming up on the North Korea side of things too over the coming months, and whether Trump will offer relief in the hopes of just sort of bolstering the sense that he's actually doing something or anything of that nature. You deal in your conclusion about where we are now, and obviously that's a constantly evolving thing. But I'll encourage listeners to get hold of the book and check that out for themselves, along with a huge amount of other content that we didn't have time to get into, from the role of China, of course, a key dimension to both countries' situations and in the past. For now, I think we'll wrap up, and I'll say thank you very much, Andre, for giving us your time today. Before we let you go, though, perhaps I could just ask you our traditional final question, namely, what is it that you're up to at the moment? What is it you're working on?
I am working on another book, which will be a general reader about North Korea, intended for a general audience, I mean, that will hopefully be able to explain a lot about the country through personal and highly readable and entertaining anecdotes. That's the hope, anyway.
Great.
I'm also working on a couple of research papers in collaboration with people here at Stanford, and puzzling through what sorts of projects might work in North Korea in the coming year. We'll see what's possible. With so much in flux, it is quite difficult to plan. The environment is changing quite a bit.
Sure. Well, it will be fascinating to keep abreast of that and see what you manage to work out, because certainly few people are in as good a position as you are to be able to assess what is and is not possible amidst an evolving situation. Thanks very much. In any case, it was great talking to you today, Andre.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Listeners, thank you as always for listening to New Books in East Asian Studies, which is a podcast on the New Books Network. We will speak to you next time. Goodbye.